Ljubljana,
Bratislava,
Amsterdam,
Warsaw,
Bucharest.
Network Europe, a partnership of the continent's leading international broadcasters. Hello, Nick Champeau here, and a warm welcome to this week's program. Coming up.
Un droit au logement opposable. C'est un principe qui placera...
The housing crisis in France is emerging as a presidential campaign's top priority. We'll have a report from Paris. Should and can the EU draw up a genuine common energy policy?
One of the growing themes within the EU, particularly since 2004, when eight former communist countries joined the bloc, is this dependence on Russia and the fear that Russia might simply, if it feels like it, simply turn off the tap.
Also in the program, we'll see how Poles are settling in Sweden and how rural development is being used as a tool to reduce the influence of the mafia in Sicily. All that and more in this week's Network Europe, so stay tuned. In France, housing has become the hot topic. Homeless people and their supporters have set up hundreds of red tents in the center of Paris, a visual and provocative way of putting the plight of the homeless into the spotlight. And it's working. Presidential hopefuls can no longer ignore it and are being forced to commit themselves. The problem is that campaign pledges on housing are rarely followed through. Radio France International Sarah Elzis reports on the issue that keeps making the headlines but never seems to get resolved.
That's the sound of anticipation. Dozens of journalists waiting to hear what Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin had to say about the housing crisis this week.
Le gouvernement souhaite mettre en place dans les meilleurs délais un droit au logement opposable.
The government wants to put in place as quickly as possible the opposable right or legal right to housing, says Villepin. Homeless people would be able to sue the authorities to force them to provide accommodation.
C'est un principe qui placera le droit au logement au même rang que le droit aux soins ou encore à l'éducation.
The idea is to put the right of housing on the same level as the right to health care and education, explains Villepin. According to the charity Emmaüs, there are as many as 1 million people without fixed housing, 100,000 of them on the street. The housing law comes after an unprecedented street movement that has brought public attention on homelessness. The Children of Don Quixote set up hundreds of red tents for homeless people and their supporters along a canal in a trendy part of central Paris. After 3 weeks, they're still there. Renaud is from the neighborhood and camped out with the group over the new year.
Obviously, we can't ask for everyone to be taken off the streets overnight. But we are asking the government to be willing to treat each individual with humanity and to ensure that each person who wants to leave the streets has a viable proposition. That's the first point.
Villepin said the mobilizations were an accelerating element to the decision to propose this law. Housing has become the issue to talk about in this election year. The outgoing government has a legacy to leave behind, which François Hollande, the Socialist Party secretary, pointed out critically. He said the government is clearing its conscience on the cheap, proposing a law they won't have to administer. Talking about housing isn't new. In a 1995 presidential campaign speech, Jacques Chirac promised housing for all. Nearly 12 years later, he's still talking about the same thing. In this year's annual New Year's address, he asked for a quick government response to make the right of housing a reality.
Faire du droit au logement une réalité. Et je demande au gouvernement d'avancer sur ce point dans les toutes prochaines semaines.
Housing studies have been commissioned before. In the past few years, socialist MPs twice introduced the concept of a right to housing. In 2000, the Solidarity and Renewal Law, called SRU, applied a quota of social housing on local governments. Town must have at least 20% of social housing by 2020. The problem is that communities are accepting fines from developers instead of the required housing units. So will yet another study and another law actually fix the problem? We'll see. The latest proposal will be presented to the cabinet on January 17th and may be voted on before parliament breaks in April. If it's passed, the right will become legally enforceable by 2008 for the homeless, the working poor, and single women with children. The right would be fully implemented 4 years later.
RFI's Sarah Elsis reporting from Paris. So busy times for politicians in France with next spring's presidential elections, and no rest for the German Chancellor either. Germany took over the European Union's rotating presidency on New Year's Day. The presidency will have a lot on its plate over the next 6 months. We'll know in detail what the priorities of German Chancellor Angela Merkel are next week, but what we already know is that along with reviving the EU's constitution, energy will top the agenda. The midterm EU summit in March will almost be entirely devoted to the energy dossier. So why is energy so important? What's at stake? We discussed the issue with our EU insider, Stephen Castle. Stephen, what's at stake here?
What's at stake is really one of the big strategic interests of the EU. If you think back to the beginning of 2006, that was dominated by a crisis between Russia and Ukraine over gas supplies. The end of the year was dominated by another rather similar dispute between Russia and Belarus over the supplies of gas. And both of these events have underlined to the big powers within the European Union their reliance on Russia as a massive energy producer. And if, again, one thinks back to last year, there have been two set-piece summits, first the G8 summit in St. Petersburg, hosted by Mr. Putin, and then the EU had its own summit in Lahti in Finland in October, to which Mr. Putin was also invited. And at both of these events, Russia's newfound power and dominance of the European energy market emerged as big themes.
But can the EU speak with one voice to Moscow?
Well, I think that's really the big question that confronts the EU as it tries to grapple with this problem of looking into the future, how it's going to develop its and diversify its supplies of energy. The big problem, as you say, is that different countries within the EU have rather different interests. For example, Germany is very dependent on Russia as a gas supplier and therefore has been extremely keen to develop its own bilateral deals with Moscow. France is slightly less dependent. It has large nuclear energy supplies of its own. Therefore, it has a slightly different perspective on this issue. I think one of the growing themes within the EU, though, particularly since 2004, when eight former communist countries joined the bloc, is this dependence on Russia and the fear among those countries, Poland in particular, that Russia might simply, if it feels like it, simply turn off the tap.
So what is Angela Merkel's aim? Then? What can she achieve in 3 months' time? Can she manage to overcome all these different strategic interests and draw up a genuine common energy policy? Is it really realistic to expect this from her and to have that result by March?
Well, I don't think we know the answer to that question. I think, however, if one thinks back even a couple of years, the idea of the EU having its own energy policy was regarded as hopelessly overambitious. Things have moved on considerably since then. There's now a consensus among all 27 EU countries that this is a very important issue. It's at the top of the agenda. The question, of course, is in the detail and precisely what the EU should commit itself to doing.
This means diversifying. It also means renewable energy. What's being done? What's the EU's approach?
Well, what we're going to see in the next couple of weeks, in fact, is there's a lot of focus on this as an issue because the European Commission is about to produce its own paper on the future of energy policy. This will eventually go to this big summit in March that you mentioned. And at the moment, the key issues here have not yet been resolved, but those will entail the targets that the EU will set itself. We don't know quite how ambitious they'll be, and then the member states will have to agree to them, and there'll be a big process of negotiation, as you can imagine.
EU insider Stephen Castle on the line from Brussels. You're listening to Network Europe. Still to come, an original project to teach Czech teenagers about human rights. and how Poles are settling in Sweden. But first, we go south. Although the Sicilian Mafia have stopped the high-profile murders and bloody gang warfare of the 1990s, the organization still controls large parts of the southern Italian island. But an EU-funded project aims to break the culture of depending on the Mafia for work by providing legal jobs in the Mafia heartlands south of Palermo. Deutsche Welle's Kate Hersine reports from Sicily.
Sicilian police desperately call for ambulances to treat those injured in the 1992 bombing of a car-carrying anti-mafia magistrate, Paolo Falcone. But for Falcone, his wife and three of his bodyguards, it was too late. Their car was completely destroyed as it passed over 500 kilograms of explosives dug into the motorway near the Sicilian capital of Palermo. When captured by police in 1996, the Mafia member Giovanni Brusca confessed to being involved in Falcone's assassination. Brusca also told police he'd committed at least 100 murders. His family's land was seized by the government and handed over to an organization called the Consortium for Legal Development. It restores property confiscated from imprisoned mafiosi and gives them back to the community. The project is the only one of its kind in Italy. According to Lucio Guarino, the organization's director, returning the property sends a powerful message.
Questo bene è un bene confiscato a Brusca, che ha gestito.
This is a property confiscated from the Brusca family, who controlled the fortunes of this territory for nearly 30 years. So it's an incredible symbol. Here, land equals power. And this project shows that, with the will of the people, it's possible to confiscate and restore mafia property.
The small stone farmhouse on the former Brusca land at San Giuseppe Iato, some 40 minutes from Palermo, was renovated in 2004. It's now Sicily's first anti-mafia agriturismo. Here, as well as spending the night, tourists can also enjoy organic pasta milled from wheat grown on Brusca's land and organic wine made from his vineyards.
La pasta. Questo è tutto con dalle terre liberate dalla mafia.
The Legal Development Consortium, which was established 6 years ago, is based in the Mafia heartlands south of Palermo. It's received €4.5 million in funding from the European Union and the Sicilian government. The consortium employs young jobless people and forms them into cooperatives. The ventures are diverse, from growing melons and tomatoes to running a vineyard and, of course, the agriturismo. In an area with an unemployment rate of nearly 30%, Guarino says that job creation is a key aspect of the project.
Because
it's only by creating work in the region that you can eliminate the privation that feeds the mafia, that gives them power. Most people would accept working for a mafia boss just so that they have a job and can take home some money. But the moment you provide people with legal work and pay their health and social insurance, you reduce the mafia's power. That's the secret of our project.
Francesco works for the Placido Risotto Cooperative, which is named for a union leader murdered by the mafia. According to Francesco, at the beginning it wasn't always easy attracting seasonal workers.
Quando si sentì che erano comunque terre confiscate al capomafia.
When they heard that the properties had been confiscated from mafia bosses, which in this region are the highest authorities, and that it was a government-run project, well, there were a lot of reservations.
Although the projects might be gradually winning over some, the local mafia bosses aren't beyond trying to intimidate their adversaries, as the project's leaders found out. Francesco reels off a list of scare tactics, such as arson attempts, crops that were deliberately destroyed, and more recently, a hanged dog.
C'è proprio un messaggio chiaro, voi qui.
That's a clear message. You are not wanted. We're not fully accepted everywhere.
There are now plans to expand the project into other areas of southern Italy. And the model has proved so successful, it has also attracted the attention of other countries with their own mafia problems, such as Georgia and Romania. Kate Hairsine, Deutsche Welle Radio, Sicily.
You're listening to Network Europe. Time now for a story on labour mobility. Workers from Poland who move to Western Europe for work often get bad press, particularly in the British tabloid media. So for a change, we head to Sweden, where apparently Poles have less difficulty integrating. Last year, Poles were among the largest groups of immigrants in Malmö, Sweden's third largest city, located at the very south of the country. Radio Polonia's Gabriel Steeler reports from Malmö.
Following the Polish EU accession, the Polish community of Malmö has been growing constantly in numbers as construction workers, doctors and nurses, to name but a few professions, are arriving. When walking the bustling streets of the city centre, hearing Polish spoken is an everyday occurrence. In three Polish convenience stores, hubs for people looking for jobs or apartments, the new labour migrants blend with Poles from earlier waves of migration, generally well established in Malmö. Britta Ström, development manager at the Department of Integration and Labour Market, City of Malmö.
People from these countries, Poland and Baltic, they come as members of EU and they are not part of our introduction programs. They find their jobs themselves and they come here for tourists, to shop and of course also to live and to work. We have had a big portion of people from Poland many years, since, as I said, from the industry period and then from the period when Poland was part of the Soviet hegemony. We have many refugees from Poland and now we have people coming here. In summertime we have many young people here. They work in the gardens, the fields. We don't have to plan for them. They find their lives themselves.
The Polish newcomers, being EU nationals, are not primary targets of the city Department of Integration and Labour Markets. On the other hand, they are met with a network of meeting places and services established by countrymen already here. A host of clubs and organizations are ready to embrace the arriving immigrants, if they should wish to be embraced. Robert Sadokierski from Polonika, the Polish Catholic Youth Association of Malmö. The most important thing is that the Polish community here, which has existed for a long time, is open to receive the newcomers, both children and adults. You can see that many who have come here are already doing quite well, as whole families and not just the guy who is working have come. We take care of those who want. We are, for instance, in the church where people know that there are associations. When it comes to the question on how the newcomers are treated by Swedish authorities, Robert Sadokierski says that from where he sees it seems that there are few complaints, especially since there are often Polish-speaking civil servants or interpreters. A cooperation between Kwiaty Polskie, a Polish cultural association, and the Swedish authorities has proven especially successful. Teresa Signarek from Kwiaty Polskie.
Förra året arrangerade vi ett informationsmöte.
Last year we arranged an information meeting with the Polish consulate, the public employment service, the social insurance agency, the tax agency and the migration board. There were interpreters and the topics were those that interested the participants. You could say it was a huge success, and there will be another one. One thing that was requested was courses in Swedish, so now our association offers that. It's a way to help.
But how are the Polish newcomers integrating in terms of getting to know Swedes? Are they keeping to themselves? There are some differences, according to Teresa Signarek, who meets all groups of Polish labour migrants while teaching Swedish.
You can say that those who work as doctors or dentists, they blend into the Swedish society in a much better way. Those who come alone, there are many with their own firms. For those, it takes a bit longer.
With the situation of Poles in Malmö as an example, an existing community can fill the double role of bringing the newcomers into the new society and to keep the traditions of the native land alive.
Radio Polonia's Gabriel Stiller reporting from Malmö. Staying in Sweden, the Swedish temperance movement has been increasingly concerned with Western liquor companies and their clever PR advertisements, aiming at new markets in developing countries, the growing middle class, and especially women. But in Sweden, a new campaign called Freedom Spirits aims at reaching both Swedes and consumers abroad about the dangers of alcohol consumption. Radio Sweden's Bill Schiller reports.
Tragic observations in many developing countries have noted those armies of poverty-stricken men in their sprawling city slums and in the countryside, spending all of their meager wages on the local alcoholic brew instead of on food for the family, badly needed medicine, or school books. But a more recent spotlight is focused on those Western-influenced ad campaigns, on highway billboards and in magazines in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, designed to capture new consumers with luxury scenes of the rising middle class enjoying expensive imported spirits, ads often for the first time including women. As a countermeasure, the Swedish temperance movement has been using sophisticated-looking leaflets, brochures, and even exhibitions offering free drinks from glamorous bottles of a brand called Freedom Spirits, containing no alcohol at all.
My name is Sarah Sundberg and I work for the IOGT N2 movement. It is one of the oldest organizations in Sweden. It was founded in USA in 1850, I think. Mainly we're working with democracy, solidarity and temperance, meaning non-drinkers.
Here you've made a wonderful bar, polar bear skins and a beautiful lamp, and you're advertising Freedom Spirits. What's in these beautiful bottles?
Well, Freedom Spirits is exactly what it is. It's a bottle full of clean water. And that's what everyone needs. I mean, everyone in the world needs to drink water to survive, but we don't need alcohol to survive. So it's actually 100% spirit in it. Spirit meaning soul.
And the campaigns now in Africa, Asia, Latin America is drink alcohol, become part of the upper class, become very trendy. What are you trying to do about this?
Well, we think it's quite bad that the alcohol industry are targeting both third world countries, but especially also women who haven't been drinking before. They haven't had the same alcohol culture as the women have had in the Western countries. So what we're doing is we're working on a grassroots level with local organizations to mobilize people to work against the alcohol industry and to work with people to inform them about alcohol and other drugs.
I see in some of your publications that you mentioned that even some countries that have a local alcohol industry, they make beer, they make wine, suddenly the multi-international companies are coming in, wiping them out. What to do about this?
Yeah, they have so-called joint ventures directly with the governments. So for example, in Laos and Vietnam, the beer company Heineken, the brewery have a cooperation directly with the Vietnamese and Laos government. Both cooperation when it comes to the brewery, but also when it comes to harm reduction. So they are actually trying to help the government to do a policy about alcohol, which is not the good way to do it.
And thanks to Radio Sweden's Bill Schiller for that interview. You're listening to Network Europe. Never again. How many times have we heard that after genocides, wars, and human rights violations? Yet these are still happening. Well, let's zoom in on an original project which is hoping to change this. So That Children Know is the title of an EU-funded project in the Czech Republic. Its goal is to teach 14 and 15-year-olds about human rights. The idea is not new. What makes it special is that it aims to break with the old practice of memorizing a text. Instead, it encourages pupils to talk about various aspects of human rights and takes them to a World War II concentration camp. Radio Prague's Daniela Lazarova reports.
If you ask Czech 8th graders about human rights, most of them will be able to reel off a few, those that concern them the most. What the organisers of the project aimed for was to give them a broader picture, to show them how human rights were violated in the past and give them a deeper understanding of what is happening in the world today. Jarmila Knight is head of the project here in the Czech Republic.
We had to find a way how to put this idea into life. And in Terezin, during the Second World War, in the ghetto, many of the human rights were abused in a way that would really make a connection for children today. One of the things how we tried to manage this was that the lecturers that took part showed the children how it would feel if, for example, they were divided into groups with others that they didn't know. They were put through the whole process of choosing what they can take with them, how it felt to be alone in a place, the living spaces where it was so crowded that they had a tiny little space for themselves and so on, how it was to be without their school friends, without their family, with no one that they could relate to, and how they had to survive.
The one-day outing to Terezin is a very different experience from studying history books or human rights documents. The students are divided into groups and each is told to choose a human right and write down in what way it was abused in the ghetto. The abuse of various human rights is then discussed in connection with the present day, in connection with dictatorships and extremist movements, even in connection with school bullying. Radka Zuzanková is an eighth grade teacher who accompanied her class on the outing.
Oni třeba se často ptají, jak je možné, paní učitelko, že všichni Hitlera poslouchali.
One question that students keep asking you there is how it is possible that all these people followed Hitler. He was just a little man, they say. So why did they allow this to happen? And I try to explain how easy it can be to get drawn into a group and blindly follow. Not just the extremist groupings that some young people join, but even to follow the example of a class leader or bully that they do not always agree with. So I say, well, why do you fall in line?
Over the past years, 600 students have taken part in this pilot project, most of them from the Czech Republic, but also from neighboring Germany and Slovakia. Its results are so encouraging that other schools will be invited to take part next year. For a country which has experienced both the Nazi and communist regimes, the lessons of the past are invaluable.
And thanks to Radio Prague's Daniela Lazarova for that report. And that's almost all we have time for on this week's edition of Network Europe. But before we leave you, listen carefully because it's time for Network Europe's quiz. As I'm sure you all know, Romania and Bulgaria joined the European Union on the 1st of January. And on New Year's Day, another former member of the Eastern Bloc joined the Eurozone. Euro notes and coins are now being used in 13 countries. We'd like you to give us the name of the new member of the Eurogroup. Five lucky winners will win special prizes. I'll repeat the question. We'd like you to give us the name of the new member of the Eurogroup. The address, contact@networkeurope.org. That's contact@networkeurope.org. Many thanks for joining us. If you want to listen to this program again, subscribe to our podcast or check out other stories from across the continent in our archives, please visit our website, www.networkeurope.org. That's www.networkeurope.org. Network Europe receives support from the European Union. From me, Nick Champeau, it's goodbye. We'll leave you with Charlotte Gainsbourg and her new single, The Song That We Sing. Thanks again for choosing Network Europe. Bye-bye.
I saw somebody who reminded me of you before you got afraid. I wish that you could have stayed that way. Little girl, I stopped and smiled at her. She screamed and ran away. It happens to me more and more. of $100 bills. If the cold doesn't kill her, none will. I read a magazine that said by 17 your life was at an end. I'm dead and I'm perfectly content. And these songs that I sing, do they mean anything to the people I'm singing them to? Sing, do they mean anything to the people we're singing?